This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 138, A Tale of True Loves. Last time, I discussed some of the inner workings of the newborn Seleucid Empire around 300 BCE, after the Battle of Ipsus had all but wiped Demetrius Polycrates and the Antigonids off of the imperial map. In many ways, the structure of the Achaemenid Empire was still there, but with greater local autonomy and Seleucus's military dictatorship keeping it all together, fueled by a constant flow of Greek and Macedonian colonists arriving in newly established city fortresses, especially in the western provinces and Bactria. The territory of the empire was smaller now, but no less unwieldy after over 30 years of constant warfare. Today, we shift focus to the Seleucid royal court and the family of King Seleucus himself. Last time, I discussed a bit of how the military, Macedonian, and lower social status of Seleucus before becoming king shifted away from the Persian royal tradition of trying to isolate the nobility from the rest of society. But many other elements of life in the royal family are constants no matter what culture underpins them. You may also remember, by the time we got to Artaxerxes II and III, that the Achaemenid royal family had gotten somewhat out of hand. There was hardly a noble anywhere in the empire without ties to the royalty through marriage or ancestry. That's kind of the whole story of how Darius III was chosen to become king in the first place. He was a distant royal cousin, but you have to go all the way back to Darius II before finding direct royal heritage. As a new dynasty, with no previous claim to power, the Seleucids are kind of starting from square one as a royal family. Much like Cyrus the Great and many other Persians for that matter, Seleucus shared his name with his own grandfather, Seleucus of Orestes. All we know about this older Seleucus is his name, from the patronym given to Seleucus's father, another Antiochus, son of Seleucus. The elder Antiochus is pretty obscure as well. Their family was part of the upper tier of Macedonian nobility, and Antiochus served as a general in the military campaigns of Philip II. Sometime during this military service, Antiochus the Elder took a break to get married to a Macedonian noblewoman named Laodike. They had two children, the future king Seleucus, and a daughter named Didumea. Seleucus would eventually name over 20 cities and fortresses in honor of his parents. However, to secure his place in the pantheon of deified Hellenistic kings and claim a bit of religious legitimacy for his rule over a vast empire, Seleucus I would eventually kind of slide his human father off to the side in favor of demigodhood. In official propaganda, Seleucus claimed that he was actually the son of the god Apollo, patron of, among other things, music, poetry, archery, young men, and eventually some aspects of the sun. Claiming Apollo as his divine parent was a strategic play by Seleucus after absorbing so many Iranians into his territory. Zeus was obviously the most powerful Greek god, but the storm god was supposed to be Alexander the Great's divine parent. Additionally, Zeus was often treated as the Greek name for Ahura Mazda when interacting with Zoroastrians, and claiming that connection would have had complex religious connotations. Instead, by claiming Apollo, Seleucus drew a connection to both his own gods and also some of the most popular divinities of the East, namely Shamash, the warrior sun god of Mesopotamia, and Mithra, the Iranian warrior divinity of oaths, horses, and also some of his own sun-adjacent topics. As an archer, Apollo was a potent symbol for representing kingship in Iran as well, where the bow-wielding hero had become a symbol of Achaemenid rule for centuries. And sure enough, Apollo started appearing on coinage in much the same way that the Achaemenid hero figure with a bow had appeared on sigloi and darics. The fact that his sister was named Didumea in honor of a shrine to Apollo also probably suggests a level of pre-existing family affiliation. 2 years older than Alexander, Seleucus entered the world in 358 BCE. By that time, the Seleucid family was already well established within the Macedonian nobility, and Seleucus would have been educated alongside the likes of Ptolemy and Alexander in the philosopher Aristotle's academy at Pella. However, it is worth remembering that the Seleucid house was originally from Orestes, roughly modern Castoria, Greece. By Seleucus's time, Orestia was considered part of Upper Macedon, but the Oresti people were still relatively new additions to the Macedonian kingdom. For most of their sparsely documented history up to this point, the Oresti were considered a Molossian tribe, even more at the fringe of ancient Greek society than Macedon itself. This is partially why names like Seleucus and Antiochus aren't particularly common among the Macedonians as a whole, at a time where any given story presents us with at least three Ptolemies, Alexanders, and Cleopatras. The Seleucids used traditionally Molossian names, Antiochus actually being a relatively common option among the Oresti. This elder generation produced at least one other Seleucid of note, King Seleucus's uncle Ptolemy. Ptolemy would actually be one of the great influences on his nephew's life. Younger than Antiochus the Elder, Ptolemy was one of Alexander the Great's first somataphylakes, guards and confidants. And as a result, he led one of the first waves of veterans to return home while Alexander was still campaigning in Anatolia. He returned with reinforcements in 333 BCE, only to die on the battlefield at Issus. After Ptolemy's death, his nephew Seleucus took a more prominent role within the ranks of the somataphylakes, the position that would ultimately earn Seleucus a place at the table during the partition of Babylon and the wars of the Diadochoi. Like the rest of their childhood family, we don't know much about Seleucus's sister Didumea either. She was married to a Greek noble sometime before the invasion of the Persian Empire, and they weren't particularly prominent in the scheme of imperial politics. Of course, they did support and eventually join Seleucus as his power grew. By the Battle of Ipsus, Didumea had two adult sons, Nicomedes and Diodotus. Those two joined their royal uncle as officers and became some of the first Greek Seleucid nobility. History mostly loses track of Nicomedes, but Diodotus was appointed satrap of Bactria, one of the key provinces for Seleucus' governing strategy, and right around the current point in our narrative, Diodotus was married and had a son while ruling from Iconium, another Diodotus, Seleucus' great-nephew. That brings me to the direct royal family, King Seleucus' own household, which began with a stroke of incredible luck in 324 BCE. That was the year when Alexander ordered all of his officers to marry Iranian women, even if they already had other wives upon returning to Susa. If you remember, the goal was to rapidly create some imperial unity between the Macedonian and Persian nobility. But it didn't really work. For one, Alexander died a year later, and unity went out the window within hours. But also, many of the Greek and Macedonian men were just indifferent to their new wives at best. Of the 80 men who married that day, 77 divorced their Iranian wives within the next few years. Hephaestion and Alexander himself both died first, and since their Susian brides were Achaemenid princesses, those women were all assassinated in short order. The only match made by Alexander that resulted in a long and seemingly happy union was that of Seleucus and Apame. Apame was the daughter of the Sogdian warlord Spidamenes, one of the leaders of the revolt against Alexander in 328, who was killed by his Saka allies in exchange for peace with the Macedonians. His daughter, Apame, was thus sent off to southern Iran as a political hostage while Alexander and company went off to India. This doesn't really sound like the foundation for a happy marriage, and technically speaking, we don't know what Apame's position was on the matter. But by all accounts, Seleucus was in love. And seeing as there's no record of animosity between the two of them, it must have been reciprocated to some extent. He named several towns and cities Apamea in honor of his new wife, and took no other brides for decades, even as the other Diadochoi happily embraced the polygamy that came with their new roles as kings. Sadly, we know relatively little about Queen Apame as well. Seleucus may have been reticent to grant her lands or involve her deeply in politics, as a reflection of the less overtly political role of women in Greek and Macedonian society. He may have kept her at political and military arm's length, given the propensity in recent years for powerful queens to wind up assassinated. It's also possible, likely even, that Apame was deeply involved just in the East, so we don't hear much about her. For that matter, even if she was largely involved in Seleucid domestic affairs within their own borders, the sources for this period are so caught up in the military dimension of things that we might not ever have heard about her. Apame would ultimately die before her husband, but it is deeply unclear when exactly that happened. She might have passed around 300 BCE, or as late as the mid-280s. She could have been anything from 40 to 80 years old, since we don't know when Apame was born. This is especially important to determining whether or not Seleucus took a second wife while Apame was still alive. Personally, I tend to think that she died around our current point in the narrative, 300 BC, shortly before Seleucus' second marriage. She appears to have been close to Seleucus in age, and it would be odd for the king to remain so staunchly monogamous up to this point, and then suddenly change tact for a mild political advantage in an alliance with Demetrius, who was floundering. Maybe Seleucus just had the incredible foresight to know that Demetrius would make a comeback, but I remain skeptical. All we really know is that both women were honored with bronze statues in Miletus around the same time, and the only source I can find that treats this as definitive proof that they overlapped is an almost comically racist book from 1975. Regardless of the exact details of Apame's passing, Seleucus did marry again, and this time to someone much, much younger than himself. While Seleucus was around 60 years old at this point, his new bride was about 20. This was Stratonike, the daughter of Demetrius Polyocrates, and their union was purely political, securing an alliance between Seleucus and Demetrius in preparation for the next big clash of Diadochoi kingdoms. Despite the politics of their union and the age gap discourse we could engage in, this was still the social role of noble women, ingrained in their education basically from birth. Stratonike would have known that eventually her father would marry her off to forge some sort of alliance, and now that day had come. They celebrated their union in one of Demetrius's loyal cities, Rhossus in Macedon, and then Stratonike went back to Babylon with Seleucus. The union was consummated and produced at least one daughter, Phila. Given that she was literally just born at our current point in the narrative, I won't deal too much with Phila today. Just note that she exists and was the only child of Seleucus and Stratonike. That brings me to the other children of Seleucus. He and Apama had at least three children we know of, including one daughter, likely named Laodike, who was married to Chandragupta Maurya and remains largely invisible to history after her marriage. Unless academic resources like Wikipedia, I occasionally see references to another daughter also named Apame, but I cannot find a source for that and assume it is probably a confusion over a granddaughter of the same name. Apame's two sons were Antiochus and Achaeus. Let's deal with Achaeus first. He was the younger brother, and thus has not been particularly involved in political or military affairs up to this point. By the Battle of Ipsus, he might not even have been an adult. But when Achaeus did reach his majority, he quickly joined his father and brother in command of the army during a war against Lysimachus in Anatolia, which we will cover in the next episode. As the second son, Achaeus was never going to be first in line for the throne, and that seems to have suited him just fine. Instead, after conquering western Anatolia, Seleucus granted his younger son control over huge swaths of land in the new provinces, and Achaeus became a prominent patron and landlord in the area. Eventually, Achaeus married and had children, maybe near the end of his father's life or soon after. Since even his first children were at best infants by the time of Seleucus' death, I won't bother introducing them today. However, as a prince and the most prominent Seleucid based in the already Hellenized regions of Anatolia, Achaeus' family became the go-to place to form Seleucid marriage pacts in the next generation of Hellenistic monarchs. That is to say, we will be hearing from all of Achaeus' kids in the coming episodes. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. That just leaves Antiochus, the crown prince who made his military debut leading Demetrius away from the Battle of Ipsus. Given his participation in that battle, we know that Antiochus was born shortly after his parents got married, sometime around 324. That would also mean that he had a very unusual upbringing. He would have been educated in the traditional Macedonian style, with noblemen, veterans, and minor philosophers as his tutors at various points, alongside the other children of nobles in the same circle as Seleucus. However, Antiochus and his siblings would have moved around quite a lot, as Seleucus shifted around himself. They would have traveled west with Seleucus, Perdiccas, and the royal entourage after Alexander's death. In fact, Antiochus probably received much of the same infant care that went to Alexander IV. But most of his early memories were formed at Seleucus's court as satrap of Babylon. Then, around age 7, Seleucus and his family were on the move once again, fleeing from Babylon to Egypt in order to escape Antigonus. That would probably have been one of young Antiochus's first formative experiences as he traveled across much of West Asia, and by extension, most of his early practical education would have happened in Ptolemy's court at Memphis, probably alongside Ptolemy's elder sons, Ptolemy Coronos and Meleager. Finally, around the time Antiochus turned 13, he, his mother, and his siblings would all have gone back to join Seleucus in Babylon once again after Antigonus's defeat in the Babylonian War. From then on, Antiochus was, for all intents and purposes, a prince, even if the official royal titles didn't start flying around for another few years. Antiochus trained and became competent enough as a student in military affairs for his father to entrust key maneuvers of the Battle of Ipsus to him. In all likelihood, Antiochus had already gained some experience in Seleucus's eastern wars, either against the Morians or in the steppe territories as a subordinate officer during his late teens. However, nothing about that period in the prince's life is documented. Antiochus only really becomes a character that ancient historians were interested in after Stratonike's arrival at court. He was an unmarried man in his early to mid-20s, and suddenly a very pretty woman, also in her early 20s, became part of the household. It's not exactly surprising that Antiochus would take an interest, even if only to befriend Stratonike, as the only royal close to his own age in Babylon. There was just one problem. Antiochus developed a crush, and that crush became an outright infatuation. This unrequited love for his new stepmother quickly became a problem for Antiochus. Several ancient sources claim that he was literally dying of lovesickness. He stopped eating, became withdrawn, erratic, and emotional. Physicians said he was at risk of dying if action was not taken. Of course, it's always dubious to diagnose someone based on poorly described symptoms 2,300 years later, but it seems pretty clear that Antiochus's unachievable crush on Stratonike drove him into a deep and spiraling depression. Seleucus couldn't allow that. Antiochus was his heir, and the only adult son with any experience to speak of. If Seleucus, now in his 60s by 293 BCE, wanted to keep leading armies into battle, he needed Antiochus alive and well to govern the empire in his absence. But this all had to happen out in the open. Oddly enough, this is a situation we've seen before with Artaxerxes II, his concubine Aspasia the Wise, and his son Darius. In that scenario, the mere implication that Darius and Aspasia could have already had an affair resulted in her exile, and eventually Darius's plot to assassinate his own father and subsequent execution. Seleucus wanted to avoid all that, and fortunately, his family didn't have the centuries of intricate court protocol and tradition that the later Achaemenids dealt with. So Seleucus simply divorced Stratonike once their daughter Phila was born, and publicly announced that she would marry Antiochus for the good of the kingdom. There were some vague accusations of impropriety and incest, but as the internet has shown us, it's his stepmom, and given that Stratonike was probably even younger than Antiochus, this match made sense to most people. The only person who could really complain was the father of the bride. Demetrius had sent his daughter away to marry a Seleucid king, not a prince. So Seleucus named Antiochus co-king, and Demetrius supposedly celebrated their union. But just put a pin in that. This is the official story, anyway. And honestly, I haven't seen many historians call it into doubt. It's just nice and makes plenty of sense as is. It can even still all be true under alternate interpretations. Namely, that this was the plan all along. If Demetrius wasn't willing to marry Stratonike to Antiochus in the first place, then maybe the plan was always that Seleucus would marry her, have one kid to prove consummation, and then have her marry Antiochus. True to form, none of the ancient authors give us Stratonike's perspective on any of this, but given that Antiochus never took another wife, it's hard to imagine that there was too much animosity once again. Regardless of specific motivations, Seleucus did find a political angle to take in divorcing Stratonike. By long-standing tradition, ancient treaties were made between kings, not countries. So when Seleucus dissolved his marriage with Stratonike, he also dissolved his alliance with Demetrius. Sometime in the early 290s, Demetrius had successfully rallied enough troops to invade and conquer Cilicia, forcing the Antipatrid Pleistarchus out of the vital coastal territory. We'll talk a little more about that next time, but for now, Seleucus seized on this opportunity of Demetrius's invasion and his own divorce as an excuse to take Cilicia for himself. When Seleucus marched off to war, he left Antiochus in command of Mesopotamia and the upper satrapies as co-king. Antiochus spent the next decade as a very busy co-ruler. In Babylonia, he oversaw quite a lot of temple construction. The Esagila, Babylon's greatest temple, was still in ruins after Alexander the Great had it torn down to the foundation, with plans to build a brand new temple in its place. One of Antiochus's first acts as co-king was to actually complete this project. While surveying the ruins of the old temple left behind by Alexander, the co-king tripped and fell over a pile of rubble, and ordered the whole site cleared before using the empty field as a banqueting space for his men. This is sometimes interpreted as Antiochus ordering the Esagila project abandoned entirely, but we know from other documents that it was eventually rebuilt and work continued. I think it's much more likely that Antiochus was injured and ordered the ruins cleared away because they were too hazardous to work around. Even as work was starting on the Esagila, another temple in the city of Eridu was struck by lightning and badly burned. So Antiochus redirected his construction efforts to the mostly intact but damaged temple instead, further delaying the Esagila project. Antiochus also oversaw the grand opening of his father's new capital city, Seleucia on the Tigris, just north of Babylon, by dedicating a brand new temple to the Babylonian moon god Sin, or possibly to a Greek god that the Babylonian Chronicle just compares to Sin. It's always hard to tell. Either way, Antiochus personally sacrificed a sheep before making preparations to move the first new inhabitants into the city. Traditionally, historians have followed the words of Pausanias regarding the establishment of Seleucia. This ancient historian claims that Seleucus and Antiochus forced most of the population of Babylon to abandon their home and move to the new city, leaving only the temple precinct of Babylon inhabited. This has often been credited with the decline of Babylon as a center of power, but frankly, it drastically misunderstands the situation in Seleucia. Cities are not built from scratch and then populated. Even in these Hellenistic colonies, a relatively small Greek-style center would be established, but whether it ever grew to become a true city depended on how well it could attract people to move in and build their own homes around that colonial center. The same Babylonian chronicle that describes Antiochus opening the Temple of Sin also describes how the first wave of migration from Babylon to Seleucia was not made up of Babylonians. It was the Greek and Macedonian diaspora that had taken up residence in Babylon that moved. All of the Macedonians that had settled in the great city were required to relocate to Seleucia, in a process overseen by Antiochus. After settling the most pressing affairs in Babylon, Antiochus went north and east, establishing his own distant court in the fledgling city of Iconium in Bactria. Antiochus would have overseen most of the new construction there as well, and helped establish his cousin Diodotus as a cornerstone of Seleucid rule in the east. This wasn't just a sightseeing expedition to his mother's homeland, though. There was evidently some sort of military threat brewing on the frontier. Sometime in the 290s, Saka raiders had crossed the Jaxartes River and destroyed Alexandria Eskete, founded by Alexander as the farthest point north in his conquest. Though Antiochus personally remained in Bactria, the soldiers, horses, and elephants he brought with him went even further north. They joined the army of Demodamas, the satrap of Sogdia, in a campaign to resettle Alexandria Eskete and cross the Jaxartes to defeat the Saka raiders. Around the same time, Antiochus commissioned one of his father's admirals named Patrocles to chart the Caspian and Aral Seas. Patrocles somehow concluded that these were a gulf with direct access to the ocean, so evidently he was not a great cartographer. But Antiochus was only the king in the east, and at least one Babylonian chronicle suggests that many of his troops and elephants had to depart Bactria for a greater conquest brewing in the west. Seleucus remained the greatest of the empire's rulers, and next time we will return, if only briefly, to the narrative of his wars with the Diadochoi. Until then. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.